If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
You make your money going in because you got to buy it at the right price. Understandable. But you've got to get out of it, you know, and the refi and hold indefinitely period works for some types. But to me, I want to make sure that there is a clear exit at some point in a reasonable future.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Evan Pulaski is the investor relations consultant for Ashcroft Capital. He spends his days working with investors to better understand their investment goals and background. With over 13 years in real estate, he has seen all sides of real estate, from acquisitions to capital raising on the equity and debt side to operations, and actively invests himself. Evan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Man, it's great to have you on. You know, the questions we always ask everyone who comes on is, where'd you start? Where are you now? And how'd you get there? So if you can give our listeners kind of a brief overview of that, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. So I started my real estate journey actually back in college. I had a friend, actually a coworker, who was studying real estate through University of Cincinnati's business school. It piqued my interest because I didn't really know that was a focus that you could take. Even prior to that, I had always been interested in real estate just as a kid. Who owns that? How can I own that kind of thing for anything?
Sure.
Hotels, retail centers, big houses, you know, all the glitz and glamoury stuff. So studied in college. Moved out of college, went into working for a retail real estate operator in the capital raising, in institutional investor, capital raising, investor relations type work. That led me promptly into the last recession, where I jumped ship into, well, got laid off, went into a leasing role, also through the recession for retail. So that was fun. And ultimately coming back to that original operator, they called me back about a year later saying, we've got a role for you. Where that helped me jump off was that was when I started investing my own money. I had coworkers that I knew through that job. This was in 2010-11 era. And they were talking about how they were buying foreclosures for dirt cheap. Talking the least I've spent on a house was $12,000 to buy it. For a 3-bedroom, 1-bath. It needed renovation, a fair amount of it. I started looking at numbers and saying, I can buy a whole house for less than I could buy a new Honda Civic. I know where my money's going. So while working in the corporate world in real estate, started buying up what now are called BRRRR properties. At the time, I don't think they had that label, but it was that same business plan, a distressed property that I could renovate, rent, refi, repeat. Did that up to about 9 units. I was admittedly was a little lazy once the bank cut me off that I was using. I didn't have the motivation to keep searching out a new bank. And they basically said, well, you've got too much exposure to you based on what you're making in your day job these days. So we can't do any more. So I continued operating those for that started in 2011. So it's been almost 10 years now. In that time, my wife left her corporate job when my son was born. We started flipping houses together. She does most of it because she's the designer side. So it's kind of a good fun, much more than a hobby for her, but a hobby, something she enjoys that has made us money. And then so have some flips. We did an Airbnb for a while. And in the last year have been focused more on, while we still do our occasional flip, selling off the long-term rentals to become a passive investor. So that brings me to where I am today, where I'm kind of actually not scaling my business. I'm bringing it down, but reallocating that money over to doing larger scale syndications.
That's awesome. So you grew your single family rental portfolio. You did some Airbnb, you tried some different things out, and then really you moved more. I think if I'm hearing you right, you've scaled by going more passively. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, it was. Honestly, it came down to a numbers game. It's nice to not be as much of a landlord. I still own a couple of my single families. But when I really started looking at it, and as I've grown, as I think a lot of investors do, particularly actively, they become more conservative.
Right.
When you buy a single family rental, you're like, I'm going to reserve $50 a month for repairs. And then you replace a roof and it costs you $6,000. And you're like, oh, I can't do that anymore. Or you realize that a brand new roof is still going to wear out in 20 to 25 years, and somewhere that money's got to come back out. So as I started looking at it that way, I started looking at what my true cash flow was and realized that these syndications are paying me more to not do as much. Admittedly, I'm in Cincinnati, Ohio, and that is a what I consider a relatively high real estate tax market. So if you go right across the river, just south of us into Kentucky, the same value is taxed, I think, less than a quarter of what I'm paying in taxes for my Cincinnati properties.
Right.
And that is a big factor in that cash flow. But at the end of the day, it came down to taking a true apples to apples comparison of what's real reserves so that I never have to touch my capital again as roofs and water heaters and everything else wear out these single family rentals. And it took properties that I was buying for all in for under $30,000, looking at a small mortgage, typically about $30,000 to $40,000 plus taxes, insurance, and those reserves. And, you know, the syndication model just made more sense from a pure number standpoint. My monthly distributions are generally equal, if not slightly higher. And there's still the appreciation when you're looking at those value add operators.
And let's not forget just the time that you're not putting in.
Correct. And I admittedly, at the scale I was at with about 9 units, it wasn't a ton of time. Of course, as you probably hear from a lot of your podcast guests that are doing it actively, 3-4 months in a row, all I do is cash a check and enter it into QuickBooks. Then I get 9 calls in the same 2 days. And it's typically when you're at the airport about to leave for vacation, the first vacation you took in 2 years. So that definitely is nicer. But I always jump back to, you know, a lot of it was more the financial equation than the time, because my portfolio was relatively small on the active stuff.
Right. So you had a nice little nest egg as you sold these off. Maybe you had a nest egg before, and then you just went out and now you've passively invested most of that. Is that correct?
That's correct. My wife and I still do a flip. Tip, as I tell people, we're part-time flippers. So I do 1, maybe 2 a year. I'm not sending out, you know, mass mailers trying to find off-market deals. It's when we're mentally capable of handling one. Again, with 2 small kids, that can always be a challenge. Then we start scouring the MLS and we'll try to find those, you know, 60 to 90 day listings where it's just been sitting. And that's the route we've been going. But again, that's almost fun part-time work that we both enjoy. We are the typical HGTV treat couple. She enjoys the design work. I like getting my hands dirty if I want to. We always budget to have a contractor handle all of the work.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And that puts some money back in the till where you can then probably reinvest that passively.
Yeah. And it definitely helps because, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, I've got a full-time job that I do, thankfully, working in real estate. And so get to talk to people about real estate all day, every day.
Right.
But it's also, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the goal is to grow the wealth. And you need money coming in to be able to reinvest it back out.
Right. So talk to us about the type of deals that you are looking at. And like, what does your buy box look like? I guess here we're recording this the first of 2021. So what does your buy box look like now? Like when I say buy box, like what is a good passive investment look like for you now?
So because a lot of my early career was spent in retail and the distress that has been happening in retail, I kind of like that. It doesn't scare me away, but it's also not my primary. My go-to is apartments. Apartments to me are the blue chip, you know, it's the Amazon stock today that, you know, it's not going anywhere. You can get some good returns out of it, but you feel safe in it because as we've seen through this recession, the impact hasn't been quite as bad as it has in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
And even in my days of retail, we always were pitching. Apartments are the best in down economies. I worked in grocery anchored shopping centers, so we kind of called that second best because people still need to feed themselves.
Right.
But I like retail as kind of the, you know, that's to me almost the venture capital play where it's, yeah, my money's going to be parked. I'm not going to see a ton out of it for the next several years. I like that cap rates are still in the 8% range, so they are kicking off some good cash on cash return. But it is a little riskier play at this point. The other place I like in 2021, and again, I'm a bit of a risk taker in this stance, is hotels, because travel will come back. To be clear, I haven't found the right hotel deal yet, but I'm trying to find something where I can place a small amount. Hopefully they'll take, you know, a $20,000, $25,000 investment that, you know, that's the, that 25 might turn into 75 in 5 years, where in the apartments, that 25 might turn into mid 30s, maybe $40,000 over that same period.
Sure.
But I feel safe about the apartments over here. The hotel's the risky fun money.
Right. No, that's interesting. Yeah. Cause those are asset classes, you know, that people are kind of fleeing from at the moment. So are you seeing, and I know you said you're still, you haven't found the right hotel, you know, operator to invest with, or hotel sponsor to invest with. But I mean, what are you seeing in those asset classes? Are those prices falling through the floor? Like
they're more so than apartments.
Yeah, sure.
But, and even mobile home parks from what I've seen, but, it just feels like they're, I wouldn't say they've fallen through the floor necessarily. It's like any investment. The people who are still cash flowing don't need to sell right now. So you are having to take some risk in buying something that is hurting the current owner in order to get those steals of deals.
Sure.
Means there's vacancy. Obviously, not a lot of retailers right now are looking to open up.
Right.
So you're trying to play that balance and you're taking on a little bit more risk, but you're, to me, I'm playing more of the sentiment game of people are scared of retail and there are true underlying dynamics that I think they are afraid of that are valid. And so that's why I said it, you know, using some friends' talking points, apartments and residential are what I understand. That's the 80% allocation. 20% goes into that higher risk play money. Play money is a bad term, but you get the idea. There's something I'm willing to put a little more risk in behind.
Right. It's I don't even want to, that's probably the wrong term as well. Play money or gambling money. It's money that you are willing to speculate with.
Correct. Yeah. That's a much clearer way of putting it. Yes.
Right. 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 No, that's great. That's great. When it comes to apartment communities, what do you like your buy box to look like in that department? I mean, especially again, you know, viewing this through the lens of the last, well, going on 10 months now of kind of insanity. So what, how has that changed and what does that look like for you?
So dialing back a little bit, even when I was starting in right out of college with that retail operator, they were a value add retail operator. So value add has always had a sweet spot for me. And I like it because I feel like it mitigates, it gets you the best returns for the lowest risk. Now, I understand a core asset is going to have a lower risk profile, but again, that risk reward profile to me is the bigger piece. I like them because particularly in a down economy, you know, you've got levers to pull since most value add operators are going to be raising for the capital improvement as well as the acquisition. So there's a lot of liquidity. Granted, it's allocated to a business plan, but if something were to happen mid business plan, they can stop those renovations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're not putting the asset into trouble. When you're going into, say, a core asset, which personally I'm not a fan of, but that's just personal preference, is there's too much reliance on uncontrollable factors. You have to assume that the property is going to continue to appreciate. You have to assume that cap rates are going to compress. You have to assume that that strong rent growth that just naturally happens year over year is going to continue happening for the next decade.
Right.
May or may not be the case. Value add is a little bit shorter horizon typically. And back to my flipping profile, you know, the fact that I do some flips, it's like, I get that. You renovate the property, you can get more rent. You know, whether you just stay on that, you're still getting strong returns, or you sell it and you get your full capital event. But there's control, even in a passive investment, from that sponsor to create that value.
Right. Can you define a core asset?
So core is typically going to be your few year old prime market, you know, just high, you know, your A asset in your A submarket and typically new. So, or at least several years old. So a lot of core buyers generally, and like I said, I don't play in the space a lot, but you know, it's the developer builds it and then sells it. And that core buyer is the buyer from the developer.
Right. Now that makes sense. And in your estimation, it sounds like in my uneducated mind, I would say that the core asset would be a less risky play.
And but, it is.
Okay. So how is that then if on the value add, you can then control expenses and it sounds like you've got more exits, you know, more ways of defining what the business looks like on a value add than you do with a core asset. So how is that a less risky play?
So the risk tends to come from typically core players are going to invest at lower leverage anyways. But because you have the new asset, there's no deferred maintenance, which clearly, again, as a flipper, renovator, you know, doing some burrs, that can add up very quickly. Right. Just escalate that on a larger scale for large value add properties. But additionally, because you're in that, in my eyes, why people like it is because you're in that A area with an A asset, you have less tenant risk because you can be much more choosy about your tenants. Now, granted, I think there's some risk associated with that that we can get into, but it's the deferred maintenance, the low leverage, the great tenant risk, or the reduced tenant risk. You know, if you're buying a property that's going to be charging, you know, $3,000 a month for a 2-bedroom, you can generally understand that you're going to have really strong credit scores. You're going to have really high incomes. And so that in general is going to reduce the risk of the tenant. Where the risk I do see comes, again, is on that downside. And you've probably heard a lot of people talk about the ladder effect. And when the economy turns, it hasn't really affected us in this current recession. But in the last recession, when those executives were getting laid off, when those VPs and director level people and higher earners were getting laid off, they couldn't afford that $3,000 a month rent anymore. So they stepped down to that Class B property, which tends to be a little bit older, but still in a good submarket. It still offers a lot of the features, the pools, the fitness facilities, the in-unit washer and dryer. You know, so you kind of can catch them on the way down in a down economy. So there is, in my eyes, that risk to a core asset.
Right.
But it comes down to the age and the ability to be picky with your tenants.
Right. And I know with all of the money printing we've been doing, it's kind of hard to actually know what the baseline is. Have we seen Class A assets? Have we seen that kind of step down yet? Or maybe you already answered that. Has that occurred in any markets that you've seen?
I don't really play in that market. I'm on a few syndication lists that are playing in that space, just a little more out of curiosity. I don't think it has in today's market, but that gets back to a lot of what you're hearing in the news of the K-shaped recovery, where the haves, the high earners, are doing better, as well, if not better, than they were pre-recession. Lower income tenants, you know, are the ones that are really feeling a bulk of that pain, which is true in all recessions, but typically in that recovery, you know, everybody's moving in the same line. Or in this one, it all the reporting I'm hearing, at least, and to somewhat you're seeing is that is not as true this time around.
Right. No, that's interesting. That's interesting. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk, you know, kind of the I'd love to hear some specifics. As you look at private placement memorandums, as you look at deals, what are some things on the structure side that are deal makers and deal breakers for you? Like, what makes you want to walk away from an operator? What makes you say, hey, I want to keep looking at that deal?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, having lived through the recession in real estate, the last recession, the 2009-10 recession, getting laid off in that period, a lot of it comes down to the numbers they're project or the assumptions that they're making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's going to say they're a conservative underwriter. To me, kind of the first red flag is, are you relying on cap rate compression? Mm-hmm. And not even cap rate compression, but are you expanding the cap rate? Are you going in at a 5 and selling at a 5.5 in your underwriting?
And that's a good thing, right?
That's a good thing. If right. I saw a 5.25 going in and the sale is at a 5, the projected sale is at a 5, it's no, I just don't trust that that's going to happen, or
right.
The business plan isn't sound enough to that you're relying on that to hit. When I've seen those periodically, they're doing that just to get the returns up to a normal level,
right?
That other operators are finding deals that are hitting those same returns while expanding the cap rate on the exit.
So you see that out of the gate and that file goes in the dumpster, like we're done.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it seems to be, if I see it on one deal, I tend to see a similar trend on future deals that I might be getting from that operator. That's not always the case.
Right.
But, you know, I'll look at each deal. I tend to be more patient with my capital to a certain extent. But I know some investors view it as, I need to get my capital out. So I'm going to take the best of what's available right now and place it there. Because to them, the mentality is, if I'm sitting 6 months to find a good deal, well, how is that? I'm earning zero for 6 whole months,
right,
or longer. What's the net effect? Should I go after a 15 IRR deal, even though I'd love an 18? Because if I wait 6 months for that 18, it brings it same time period, brings it down to 15. So again, it's a balance. That's kind of the biggest red flag that I look at. But then it's starting to do some of your own due diligence of, you know, all right, you're projecting a 2% year over year rent growth. You're telling me that market has historically grown at 4%. That's probably accurate. I don't think you're lying to me, but I'm going to do a quick Google search here and just see what rent projections are for that particular market. You know, another one, and again, this is kind of a high level, easy to throw away, is like,
yeah,
suburban major metros. I don't want to buy in, no offense to Cincinnati, I live here. It's not an area that I would invest for large scale apartments where I'm trying to sell to an institutional buyer, because there are other demographic areas or demographic changes. The big one being that Cincinnati in particular does not have very strong population growth. You know, so for my single family investments, haven't had any issue with investing in Cincinnati. Four families, duplexes, even 20, 25 units. But if I'm talking a passive deal where I'm where I'm a small piece of 250 units, who's the buyer for that when I'm living here? I know that most of the large scale complexes are controlled by a handful of local operators.
Right.
And are they going to be interested in this deal? And if they are, why didn't they buy it instead of the syndicator that I might be investing with is the one getting it? Right. So a lot of that play. But your major metros, you know, your Florida markets, your Southeast, your Texas, the ego in me still loves California, even though I know the dynamics there are not there. So I don't actually invest there, but I would like to pretend that I will sometime.
Right.
Those are kind of the high level ones too, where it's just, it's got to be a good market. You got to be able to get out of the asset.
Right. And that's a fascinating point that you make, because like you said, the buyers for, let's say you did, you know, you got in on this deal, they improved it, they added, you know, the NOI is healthy and they could resell it. But if there's no one to buy it, who are they going to sell it to? Because your local buyers, if it's four or five local buyers that own everything over 200 units and they're not interested, then that's the end of it, because the institutions aren't buying in Cincinnati.
Correct. It's the saying of, you make your money going in because you got to buy it at the right price. Understandable. But you've got to get out of it, you know, and the refi and hold indefinitely period works for some types. But to me, I want to make sure that there is a clear exit at some point in a reasonable future. Market dynamics change, pandemics hit, and it doesn't make sense to sell. Get it. But ultimately, is there a buyer pool in that market? And the bigger that buyer pool, the more comfortable I know that I'm going to get my money back and hopefully a healthy profit on top of that.
How does a passive investor vet that metric? Like, how do they say, oh, there is a buyer pool, there isn't buyer pool? Like, how does somebody go about doing that?
I think it's back to underwriting the deal to a certain extent. But the easiest way, I would say, is go to Google Finance and find what the publicly traded REITs are and see where they own. You know, because ultimately where they're buying is where pension plans will be investors, where foreign capital will be investors. And again, I'm talking large scale projects.
Right.
Your 20 units are much different than trying to sell 400 units for $70, $80 million. So, you know, that's exactly what I did. I went to, Avalon Bay and Equity Residential. And a lot of these guys focus more on core assets, but you know, they're doing the research. Where can they get rent growth? Where is their population growth? Which again, tends to create rent growth, employment growth, diverse economies, all those things. And then you layer in, you know, legacy assets that California was hot I shouldn't say too long ago, it still is hot, but a lot of people are fleeing California, not just from a population standpoint for multiple reasons, but the landlord laws tend to be very stringent there,
right,
particularly in this pandemic. And it's causing institutional capital to not want to get stuck with something where they can't evict pay tenants because the laws say that they can't evict a tenant. So you got to play a little bit balanced, but that's where I started my research, is again, where do the big publicly traded companies invest? Okay, those are good markets because they're doing the research. They have analysts building out those profiles.
Right, man, that's a very actionable, very, very tangible thing to do. Like that's very easy, I think, for most of us to understand. So that's awesome. Evan, let's jump into the final four here if we can. If you were to take everything you know, distill it down to one piece of advice, and you're giving it to an aspiring investor, what would that one piece of advice be?
Get started. The real answer is that first house that I ever bought, as soon as the realtor told me, you've been awarded the deal, I started second guessing everything I thought about that house. Why did I get it? There's a lot better investors out there that didn't bid as much. Am I about to walk into a hornet's nest? You got to kind of just jump past that and trust your initial instincts. Don't let the excitement overwhelm you, like where your everything's great, but you know, you just got to forge ahead and trust those instincts that made you offer on that single family property. Or if you're jumping into syndications, same idea. Like you can't keep second guessing yourself.
Right. Oh, that's awesome. What's one thing you're currently doing to stay on top of your game?
Hopefully reviewing a lot of deals. Because again, the more, especially as a passive investor, but true as active, the more deals you review, even without moving on, the more you're going to start picking up bits and, oh, they're doing this way. Okay. What happens if I try to change that piece on this deal? Is that going to change things dramatically? And you just get that from exposure.
Right. No, that's awesome. When it comes to giving back, what's one thing you're doing to make the world a better place?
As the father in me, hopefully raising two very good kids. You know, it's time with the community, time with friends, and offering my expertise to people. And, you know, without any, hopefully it's implied, but without any strings attached of, oh, if I do this for you, you've got to do something back. And it's, you know, just that pay it forward strategy.
Well, yeah. And it's taking 40 minutes out of your work day to come on a podcast where you don't get paid anything to show up. So
yeah, that's are fun. So there is a little bit of, you know, personal, I like doing these things, but no, it is exactly that. Sharing your knowledge to make somebody else's life hopefully a little bit better.
Right. No, that's awesome. And Evan, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
LinkedIn is kind of my primary go-to. So find me on LinkedIn, Evan Pulaski, and connect with me there, send me messages there. And we'll, you know, of course I have email and phone numbers, but start there and we'll move that direction as needed.
Sounds great. Evan, thanks so much for coming on today. Certainly appreciate it.
Yes, it was my pleasure, Sam. Great talking to you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.